Hello, this is Aiden Penza, and for the next hour, I'll be reading from the October 1st issue of the Democrat and Chronicle on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Teachers paying out of pocket for supplies. Budget cuts, inflation, making it harder to meet students' needs. Shanna Danielson, a music teacher at Bermudian Springs Middle School near Gettysburg, Pennsylvania, admits she spent a, quote, stupid amount, unquote, of her own money on artificial plants to transform her cinderblock-walled classroom into a cozy jungle. Her son donated many of the stuffed animals that peek through the leaves at practicing students. She also loves buying props that add pizzazz to band performances, including a penguin cutout that stood on stage as students performed Penguin Promenade during the 2024-25 school year. "I'm ashamed to admit I spent like $50, she said, "but you should have seen the joy on their faces." Teachers like Danielson can spend hundreds of dollars out of pocket trying to make learning fun for students. Other teachers might spend just as much on necessary school supplies like pencils and books, especially at low-income schools where resources are sparse and families can't afford to buy their own materials. Some teachers buy snacks for their classrooms, too, knowing kids need fuel to focus. Not only are teachers expected to fill in those gaps where students can't get their own school supplies, so we're buying pencils and notebooks and pens, we're also constantly replacing these items, you know, because things get lost or things get broken, said Adriana Ocañas, consumer credit cards analyst at U.S. News & World Report. Ocañas spent 3 years as a teacher before switching careers. During the 2024-25 school year, teachers spent, on average, $884 of their own money, $3.35 billion total, on cleaning supplies, prizes, snacks, decorations, books, pens, paper, hand sanitizer, and more, according to My E-Learning World. A survey from Adopt a Classroom found teachers on average spend $895 out of pocket on school supplies, a 49% increase since 2015. Teachers told the USA Today Network the amount they spend varies. Some educators rely on local grants, donations, and online wish lists through Amazon, Adopt a Classroom, Donors Choose, and other platforms to stock their classrooms. One teacher near Seattle promotes other teachers' wish lists online. An Emmy Award-winning actress, Kristen Bell, noticed. Bell cleared some of the teachers' wish lists on Sarah Stair's website last year, and recently gifted Stair $25,000 to help clear teachers' wish lists ahead of the 2025-26 school year. Every year, most teachers use their own paychecks to make sure schools are a happy and safe place for our kids, Bell wrote in an August 15th Instagram post. Please consider donating if you can, and let's show up for our educators. I was shocked, Stair said, about getting Bell's attention for the first time. I thought it was fake at first. Stair enjoys helping fellow teachers with school supplies, but she said there are many other issues in education that put a strain on teachers. I can't necessarily make a huge systemic change overnight happen, but hopefully I can bring awareness to people who don't realize how much teachers are having to invest, Stair said. America needs to do better in funding schools and paying teachers what they deserve, said Princess Moss, vice president of the National Education Association. In 2023-2024, the national average public school teacher salary rose by 3.8% to $72,030, according to the association's most recent Educator Pay in America report. But average teacher pay hasn't kept up with inflation, the report found, and nearly 17% of American school districts offer starting salaries of less than $40,000. Teachers are going to do what they need to do to ensure that their students have what they need in order to survive and to thrive, Moss said. What other professionals are asked to fund their work? Danielson said she spends roughly $400 to $600 each year on students. Though her district gives her a small annual budget for beefing up her classroom instrument inventory, the funds are for approved vendors that mostly sell new instruments. She can't use this money to snap up a cheap find from eBay, and it doesn't stretch as far as she'd like. So, sometimes she dips into her personal money when she stumbles across a good quality flute on Facebook Marketplace or a trombone at a garage sale. "It's very frustrating," she said. "I don't feel like money should ever keep somebody from loving or learning music." "Teachers are feeling squeezed," said American Federation of Teachers President Randy Weingarten. "They need more resources to help make their classrooms the safe and welcoming places that students need to learn," Weingarten said. "What other professionals are asked to fund their work like teachers?" At Coachella Valley High School in Thermal, California, history teacher Perla Penalber estimates her yearly out-of-pocket spending at $1,800 for classroom basics, club expenses, and items to make her room more welcoming. She doesn't ask families for contributions or post online wish lists, since many of her students come from migrant families, working in agriculture and often face financial hardship. Budget cuts and inflation only add to the challenge. "But it's worth it," Penalber said, especially when she sees even reluctant learners motivated by the activities she's able to provide. "It's not about how much you're getting out of it," Penalber said. "It's more about what you're giving back that's going to continue to give to the future, and hopefully they'll take that with them." Counselors spend $300 per month feeding, clothing students. Teachers aren't the only school employees spending their own money to help students. Lakeisha Bear Myers, a social worker at a Central Pennsylvania school district, said she's become an expert coupon clipper and bargain hunter as she stocks up on food and clothes for students. Bear Myers, who's worked at Reynolds Middle School in Lancaster since 2017, said she purchases school supplies in bulk at Staples during store clearances and once grabbed 40 sweatshirts from Kohl's because they were on a steep markdown. These finds are stored in a small office that she calls the Care Closet, where students can browse for toiletries, socks, underwear, food, shoes, and other items they and their families might need. She said 40 to 50 students come to her each day for breakfast, lunch, or snacks. Bear Myers relied on her own money, about $300 per month, with coupons, when she was feeding 10 kids per day. But in recent years, her community's needs have dramatically increased. Now, she said she gets help from community organizations that contribute food and monetary donations. "It causes a great amount of stress and uneasiness because teachers are facing the same financial hurdles that our students' families are feeling," Bear Myers said. Event to support teachers brings community together. Tariffs could impact school supplies this school year, Ocañas said, especially on items like backpacks, laptops, clothes, shoes, pencils, and pens. 8 in 10 teachers in the Adopt a Classroom survey said inflation and rising costs of school supplies were a concern. And a recent U.S. News & World Report survey found parents might not be as willing to help teachers out because of rising costs. The share of Americans planning to spend $101 to $300 per child when shopping for back-to-school items dropped from 52% last year to 41% this year, survey data shows. More than one-third of caregivers said they'd donate $20 or less to their kids' classroom for supplies this school year. Still, Ocañas suggests teachers reach out to their community for help if they need it. Given the opportunity, the Covington, Kentucky community came out in full force to support their teachers during a school supply event in August. The Kenton County Public Library branch in Covington found a surplus of gently used supplies while restructuring the building. Then community members donated other new and used items to the cause. Dagmar Morales, the branch programming coordinator, said 85 teachers and homeschool families picked up supplies during the event. Morales estimates the supplies added up to about $10,000. Teachers told her they felt overwhelmed by the support, she said. She hopes the library can pull off the event again next year. "It was an event that brought the community together," Morales said. SUNY to review all race-based awards. How many scholarships may be halted is unclear. SUNY told its colleges and universities to review any scholarships targeted to specific races, genders, or historically unrepresented groups due to new legal constraints posed by a 2023 Supreme Court decision on affirmative action, state records show. But over the past 2 years, New York's public college system has said little publicly about how it was working with its 64 campuses to potentially halt scholarships based on factors impacted by that 2023 court decision. On September 26, SUNY officials told USA Today Network that the work continues, but it remains unclear how many scholarships could be affected by the policy. The policy came to light recently after a Rochester area community college asked a donor to change a race-based scholarship, but the donor refused. The situation is unfolding in the midst of a Trump administration push to uproot racial preferences and efforts to promote diversity, equity, and inclusion, known by the shorthand DEI. In public previously, SUNY has fully embraced DEI in the face of that opposition. In May, SUNY Chancellor John King Jr. extolled it as one of our pillars at SUNY, woven into classroom studies, faculty recruitment, anti-bigotry efforts, and more. DEI is the secret sauce that gives universities the unique power to bring Americans together across all lines of difference, geography and race, religion and income, politics and nationality, King said in his annual State of the University speech in Albany. It is our responsibility to give our students the chance to understand each other and find commonalities within those differences. But behind the scenes, the shifting legal climate appears to have taken a toll on SUNY scholarships aimed at diversity. A Rochester TV station recently reported the demise of a Monroe Community College scholarship for students of color graduating from a Rochester high school. Its founder created it 8 years ago in honor of his late girlfriend, who was African American and attended Rochester schools. SUNY has asked us to review all scholarship criteria that reference race or gender, the college reportedly wrote to the donor, Jim McGrath, according to an email quoted by News 10. McGrath was asked to eliminate the scholarship's preference for African American students and other historically underrepresented groups, which he declined to do. What does SUNY say in response? The college's email to McGrath cited a Supreme Court decision that determined such language could be considered discriminatory. The court took the historic step in 2023 of prohibiting racial preferences in college admissions, declaring the practice unconstitutional and requiring students be admitted based solely on colorblind criteria. In response to questions about SUNY's new scholarship policy, a spokeswoman for the state system emailed a statement affirming its commitment to broad accessibility and representation in its student bodies. As for scholarships, SUNY will, quote, continue to adhere to the mandate issued by the prior federal administration's Office for Civil Rights, end quote, the statement read. The spokesperson, Holly Liapis, didn't respond to follow-up questions seeking more information. The USA Today Network has asked SUNY to provide a copy of its scholarship directive through a public records request under the state Freedom of Information Law. A Monroe Community College spokesman provided a statement saying the college was ensuring its admissions, operations, and scholarship programs align with federal and state laws, as well as SUNY's recommendations and overall mission. He declined to answer questions. Spokespersons for five other SUNY schools contacted by the USA Today Network didn't respond to requests to discuss the directives they had received and the impact on their scholarship programs. They are Purchase College, Westchester Community College, SUNY Orange, SUNY New Paltz, and Binghamton University. What have the Biden and Trump administrations done? 6 weeks after the 2023 court decision, the Biden administration issued guidance to colleges on strategies they could use to diversify their enrollment in spite of the new bar on racial criteria. In a 6-page set of questions and answers, it suggested such approaches as weighing a student's disadvantaged background or socioeconomic status instead. The advice, issued jointly by the Education and Justice Departments, was meant to maintain college diversity and was focused on admissions. It said nothing about how to handle scholarships. In February of this year, the new Trump administration took a broader view by telling schools at all levels that the affirmative action ruling prohibited them from considering race in any decisions. In its letter, it said that included admissions, hiring, promotion, compensation, financial aid, scholarships, prizes, administrative support, discipline, housing, graduation ceremonies, and all other aspects of student, academic, and campus life. That directive is being challenged in federal court. This month, the U.S. Education Department canceled $350 million in grants targeted to colleges and universities with high minority student populations, and said the funding would be shifted to other programs. Diversity is not merely the presence of a skin color, Education Secretary Linda McMahon said in a statement about the grant decision. Stereotyping an individual based on immutable characteristics diminishes the full picture of that person's life and contributions, including their character, resiliency, and merit. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the Democrat and Chronicle on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Drop in interest rates, car prices could increase sales. As new and used car prices continue to drop, and there's talk of the Federal Reserve lowering interest rates, some people might be considering buying that new or used vehicle they've put off for a while. According to Edmunds.com data, the average transaction price of $47,616 for June was down 0.7%, or about $330, from $47,946 in June 2023. And car buyers are getting a bigger discount from the sticker prices. Edmunds data showed the average manufacturer's suggested retail price was up 1.6% at $49,434 in June, compared with $48,651 a year before, basically giving car buyers a $1,819 discount versus a $704 discount a year ago. Prices are dropping for used cars, too. The average customer paid $27,277 in August, compared with $29,573 a year ago, Edmunds data showed. But as the year progresses, car makers are not expected to offer a lot of deals, said Cox Automotive executive analyst Aaron Keating. Even brands holding on to more a day's supply, like many Stellantis brands, are keeping incentive spend in check, Keating said. There appears to be a real effort to hold the line out there. So, for those who want to strike the best deal on a new or used car, here are some tips from the experts on the best way to shop. Come prepared, but be open-minded. The key to a successful car purchase is to know one's options before arriving at a dealership. That means knowing everything from particulars of the new vehicle itself, the value of any trade-in, which can be found online or obtained from an expert, interest rates, and what one qualifies for, to what is negotiable in the price and what isn't, said Ivan Drury, director of insights at Edmunds.com. Let's look at financing. Experts agree it's wise to go to a few banks or credit unions to get pre-approved in order to know the interest rates for which one qualifies on both new and used vehicles. Why both? Drury said. Because shopping online versus being at the dealership are two completely different experiences. You might fall in love online with a listing, but one test drive later with a seating position that you find unbearable, and you're back to seeing what other fish are in the ocean. Or, in this case, you might go from shopping new to seeing an excellent used option on the other side of the lot. Drury said that even with pre-approval with the bank, let the dealership also look for loans. Dealerships work with multiple financial institutions and often have deep relationships with them from years of dealmaking. Drury said if a dealer can save a buyer even just a quarter point in interest, it is worth it. There is one financial institute that franchise dealers have access to that you don't, the automaker's captive finance company, Drury said. This is where dreams of 0%, 1.9%, 2.9% financing come true, if you're lucky enough to be looking at a vehicle that has one of these low APR offers. So let the dealership run your numbers. But before jumping at any financing deals the captives offer, do the math to see whether the savings in interest will be greater than whatever cash savings offer might be on the table. Negotiate on fees. Matt Smith, head of consumer insights for car shopping site CarGurus, said beyond coming in with pre-approved financing, the most important figure to look at is the total out-the-door cost for the vehicle. That figure will include all fees and taxes, because some fees may be negotiable. Look for an itemized list of the fees, Smith said. They might not take a dealer fee off, but they might make adjustments elsewhere in the deal. If a dealer really wants to sell a car and move some metal at the end of the month, then I don't think anything is off the table. Used cars might carry fees for rust-proofing or undercoating that a buyer might negotiate, for instance, Smith said. But one fee on a new vehicle is almost always non-negotiable, the destination charge. That is typically over $1,000, he said. Car buyers have another potential weapon in their arsenal, Smith said, the finance and insurance products. If the dealer isn't going to budge on price, see if they'll include tire and wheel coverage in the deal, Smith said. Tire and wheel coverage often takes care of replacing tires and rims if they are damaged by bad roads. Can be a valuable add-on depending on where a buyer lives and the road quality, Smith said. But avoid extended warranties, because those rarely pay off, he said. Get away from monthly payment mentality. A big mistake many car shoppers make is looking at the monthly cost of the vehicle. Experts understand why. Consumers want to make sure it fits into their budget. But that's not the way to get the best deal. Because we see loan terms stretch out to 72 months or 94 months, it might feel good for your monthly payment, but with interest rates over that long, it ends up being more than what you're actually paying for the car, Smith said. So figure out the out-the-door cost. Drury agreed, saying salespeople will often ask what a buyer is looking to spend on a monthly basis or their current payment amount. None of that matters, he said. What matters is how much you want to spend today on this purchase, Drury said. Just because you're currently doing something or have the ability to do more doesn't mean you should. Know your numbers, and if you want, flip the question to be about the present vehicle. But also know that wherever you start, it is not going down from there. Putting money down on a lease or not. For those who choose to lease a new car, the dealership often asks for a couple $1,000s down. This results in a lower monthly payment than purchasing a car does. But given that there will be no equity in a lease, is it wise to hand over $2,000 or more that the lessee might not get back? Drury recommends zero down or a low down payment when the interest rate for the lease is low. This would result in a higher monthly payment, but it does leave you with more cash on hand for other expenses, planned or otherwise, Drury said. I say this so that the buyer is borrowing more cheap money versus putting up a lot up front. But if the interest rate is high for the lease, then a higher down payment should lower the monthly payment and would be advised to minimize how much a lessee spends just to borrow the car during the duration of the lease. What to look for in a test drive. Now let's look at the shopping and test driving experience. Smith said always set up an appointment with the dealership before showing up. Otherwise, the car you wanted might be sold already, Smith said, and negotiate a price ahead of time. These people are professional negotiators, so get as much in writing ahead of time. Showing up and saying, "What have you got for under $20,000?" is not a successful negotiating strategy anymore. Do not be afraid to ask detailed questions about the vehicle, Drury said, because even the same model can undergo drastic changes from one model year to the next, some obvious and others not. You don't want to buy a new vehicle in July only to find out that the next model year is being sold in September and has that one feature you really want, Drury said. This applies to used vehicles as well. Saving money by purchasing an older version of the same model might not be worth it if you find out after the fact that you missed out on that one little option that could make your life so much easier. Drury recommends these shopping tips. Do homework on the vehicle's features online first, but ask the salesperson detailed questions and see the features in person. Look at the automaker's media/news release website, but know that not all information about future products is readily available when buying. Find the right fit when it comes to trim levels and options, because a buyer thinking they can live without something to save up front could cost them later if they find they want a different trim package after purchase. One of the biggest mistakes that happens is trading in a vehicle within a month, a year, or even 2 years. Unless you're putting up a massive down payment or have a lot of positive equity, you're going to be either in negative equity or having eaten a lot of depreciation, Drury said. Choose the options that help every time the vehicle is driven. For example, heated or ventilated seats are nice in an area where the weather varies greatly. For those who are bad at parking, then cameras can help, Drury said. But opting for a moonroof that you keep closed 95% of the year, probably not as worthwhile. Shop right for the weather. Something else to keep in mind when shopping, Drury said, is that a bad weather day is a car shopper's dream. There will be fewer people at the dealership, and you can test drive a vehicle during a time in which you really need to know what you're getting into, Drury said. Bright, sunshiny days are great and all, but newer vehicles tend to have less glass for safety reasons, and that could translate into more blind spots than you're accustomed to. For used vehicles, the opposite is true. A buyer wants a bright enough day so that they can see the vehicle to spot imperfections. Still, Drury said, make sure to drive it in the rain, too, before buying it to see whether there are any leaky seals or foggy headlights or taillights. And even if it is hot outside, test the heater, heated seats, and heated steering wheel. If it is cold, try the air conditioning or ventilated/cooled seats. Silence is golden during a test drive. The test drive is as important as the negotiations, so here's how to approach it. Test the stereo, but only briefly, Drury said. During most of the test drive, silence is golden. You want to hear any noises or just in general how much road noise enters the cabin. Pair your phone, see if the infotainment system is up to your expectations. If it or any other features annoy you today, they'll annoy you tomorrow and for the rest of your ownership experience. Smith has this list of tips to consider when test driving a new or used vehicle. How does the car accelerate? Are there any odd vibrations? Is it shifting erratically? Roll down the windows and listen to the brakes. If brakes must be replaced, a metal-on-metal sound or a squealing can be heard. Touch all the buttons and make sure they are comfortable to use. Watch YouTube car reviews ahead of time because they go into the technology of the car. Sit in all the seats. For those who have a small child, bring the car seat to make sure it is easy to get in and a stroller fits in the trunk. Dog owners can ask if they can bring their dog to see if he or she fits in the vehicle. Chinese goods under U.S. crackdown. The United States on September 29th cracked down on companies in China and other countries that use subsidiaries or other foreign affiliates to get around curbs on chip-making equipment and other goods and technology. The Commerce Department issued a new rule expanding its restricted export list, known as the Entity List, to automatically include subsidiaries owned 50% or more by a company on the list, according to a posting in the U.S. Federal Register. The action greatly increases the number of companies that require licenses to receive American goods and services. The rule is likely to disrupt supply chains. It will also make it more difficult for companies to determine whether exports to a customer or supplier are restricted. According to the rule, certain transactions may be allowed for 60 days. China's Commerce Ministry strongly criticized the rule. "This move by the U.S. is extremely egregious in nature," the ministry said in a statement. "It seriously infringes upon the legitimate rights and interests of the affected enterprises, severely disrupts international economic and trade order, and gravely undermines the security and stability of global industrial and supply chains." The timing of the rule's release is somewhat surprising, given that the United States and China are in the midst of trade talks. The action strengthens export controls on China, a contrast to the Washington's recent loosening of controls on AI chips to China, like NVIDIA's H2O. If a company is owned 50% or more by an entity on the list, licenses will be required for U.S. exporters to ship goods or technology to the subsidiary, just as they are for listed entities, with many licenses likely to be denied. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the Democrat and Chronicle on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Feds Myron advocates for lower rate, and soon. But experts say fast cuts could cause problems. New Federal Reserve Governor Stephen Myron's call for big interest rate cuts is based on faith that President Donald Trump's economic plans will quickly lower the rate of interest that would prevail in a healthy economy, something policymakers see as hard to estimate under the best conditions. It is an outlook that, in Myron's view, puts the economy at a pivotal point right now, with the Fed risking a fractured job market by leaving interest rates far above a neutral level he feels is falling to near zero. It is very clear people don't feel urgent, Myron said on Fox Business of the Fed's recent decision to cut interest rates a quarter of a percentage point while he dissented in favor of a half-point cut. His colleagues, he said, are still very scared of tariff inflation. Rather than worry about relatively small price changes in some imported goods due to tariffs, policymakers should focus on administration border and fiscal policies that will reduce the neutral rate, he said in a recent speech. But it is a view also out of step with how other analysts and central bankers generally think about current policy and the neutral rate that neither stimulates nor restrains the economy, which they estimate at roughly a percentage point higher than Myron. There is debate about whether the neutral rate may be rising or falling due to changes in the economy and longer-term forces like demographics, and thus disagreement about whether current Fed policy is exerting a lot or only a little restraint on spending and investment. If monetary policy were as out of line as Myron thinks, why hasn't inflation come down more sharply and quickly? Former St. Louis Fed President James Bullard said on CNBC. Now dean of Purdue University's Business School, Bullard is under consideration for Fed chair and noted the risks of Trump's assertion that aggressive rate cuts could simply be followed by rate hikes if inflation increases. At that point, you have a whipsaw kind of policy. Then markets start to worry, they start to price in inflation risk, and that's very hard to get rid of. It's a careful game they have to play. Myron, on leave from his job as chair of Trump's Council of Economic Advisers, isn't shy about the wedge between his views and the Fed consensus, which he says he is happy to avoid through continued dissents as he argues his case. He may find it hard to sway the debate. Longtime Fed analyst and J.P. Morgan economist Michael Feroli said he found some of Myron's arguments questionable, others incomplete, and almost none persuasive. In addition to brushing off concerns about Trump's tariffs, Myron has said rent inflation would slow sharply as the president's crackdown on immigrants reduces demand for housing. But the math he used to support the argument may have overstated the impact, Reuters recently reported. Myron acknowledged he may have been optimistic in his view, but stood by his belief that forecasters have not fully appreciated the effect of immigration policy on rents. Despite questions about his reasoning, Myron's opening position does start a reckoning over Trump's potential to shape a Fed more aligned with his views. Trump is trying to force out Governor Lisa Cook and plans to replace Fed Chair Jerome Powell when Powell's term expires in May. Despite calling for half-point cuts, Myron's first speech did include a wide path for rates, hinging on whether Trump's immigration, trade, tax, and regulatory policies have the impact he expects, at the near-term pace Myron anticipates, in lowering the neutral rate. Abstract and hard to pin down, estimates of neutral are fundamental to monetary policy thinking, representing the line between rates that hold the economy back and lower inflation, and rates that encourage economic activity, boost jobs, and raise price pressures. Myron argues it is dropping, and that other estimates are so bound to historical data the Fed doesn't see it. With a neutral rate at or close to zero, adjusting for the Fed's 2% inflation target implies a Fed rate of between 2% and 2.5%, a roughly 2-point gap with today's 4% to 4.25% policy rate range. Myron feels the Fed should cut to neutral quickly, in half-point steps, since he sees inflation returning to the Fed's 2% target with little risk of tariffs driving it higher. It is an all-in bet other policymakers see as risky. Powell, in particular, is reluctant to put much policy weight on estimates of the neutral rate, and says it is best to gauge the stance of policy by what's happening in the economy. A nod to data over models and forecasts. Inflation remains around 1 point above the Fed's target, and the 4.3% jobless rate is close to estimates of full employment, numbers that have kept Myron's colleagues hesitant to cut in more than the typical quarter-point increments. Trump's announcement of new, steep tariffs on household furnishings also shows the broader policy environment remains unpredictable. Research by Lucas Rachel, a University College London assistant economics professor whose earlier work Myron cited in stating that tariff revenue will lower the neutral rate, concludes that emerging trends like deglobalization and the capital demands of artificial intelligence could drive developed world neutral rates steadily higher, with a sharp turnaround possible if several of the potential risks develop at once. Myron acknowledged some of the issues with his approach, saying in his speech he was not attempting to provide an impossible degree of precision. Rochester joins national effort to go car-free. Reconnect Rochester invites Monroe County residents to participate in its initiative for the National Week Without Driving. The Week Without Driving was first launched by Disability Rights Washington in 2021 to highlight the challenges individuals that don't have car access face. By 2023, individuals across the country began to participate in the week-long challenge. The average commute in Rochester is 4.1 miles, a very doable distance for your average cyclist or a quick bus trip, says Chaz Goodman, marketing manager at Reconnect Rochester. Nationwide, 40% of car trips are less than 2 miles, with 28% less than 1 mile. Leaving your car at home may be easier than the average person realizes. Many people, including a quarter of Rochester residents and 11% of Monroe County, get by every day without a car. We're trying to inspire people to rethink what's possible in their own travels, said Goodman. The initiative will be September 29th through October 5th. Reconnect Rochester invites residents to track their non-driving miles throughout the week to show the collective impact of reducing vehicle use. Participants will receive daily emails with guidance and mini challenges to win prizes. Each day will highlight different mobility options, including walking, biking, bus, and e-scooters. Participants are encouraged to choose the method that works best for their travel and schedule. Why reduce car use? According to Reconnect Rochester, reducing reliance on driving can have a range of impacts, including lower transportation costs for households, reduced traffic congestion, less demand for roadway and parking infrastructure, and supports safer streets and more efficient use of community space. To learn more, visit reconnectrochester.org/week-without-driving. Four corrections officers in Robert Brooks' case take plea bargains. Of the corrections officers in the Robert Brooks case, only three are going to trial, after four accepted plea deals at the last moment on September 22nd. Brooks, a grease man and inmate transferred to Marcy Corrections Facility on December 9th, was brutally beaten with his hands cuffed behind his back by corrections officers while in custody. He was pronounced dead the next day. An autopsy was conducted by the Onondaga County Medical Examiner's Office, and, in February, Brooks' death was ruled a homicide. Nicholas Anzalone, Anthony Farina, Michael Mashaw, and David Walters pleaded guilty at the pretrial conference for the case on September 22nd. Anzalone, 44, and Farina, 49, pleaded guilty to the lesser charge of first-degree manslaughter and will be facing 22 years in state prison, with 5 years post-release supervision. Mashaw, 48, and Walters, 37, pleaded guilty to the lesser charge of second-degree manslaughter. Mashaw will be facing 3 to 9 years in state prison, and Walters to 2 1/3 to 7 years in state prison. All four men are returning before Judge Robert Bauer for sentencing on November 21st. Christopher Walrath and Nicholas Gentile pleaded guilty early in the trial. Walrath pleaded guilty to first-degree manslaughter and was recently sentenced to 15 years in federal prison. Gentile pleaded guilty to attempted tampering with physical evidence, a misdemeanor, and accepted a sentence of a 1-year conditional discharge after resigning from his job. Plea deal rejections. David Kingsley, Michael Fisher, and Nicholas Kiefer chose to fight the charges, with a trial date set for October 6th. Kingsley was offered a chance to plead down to the lesser charge of first-degree manslaughter and a sentence of 22 years in state prison, but rejected the deal. If Kingsley is found guilty of his top charge, second-degree murder, he could face a sentence of life in prison. Fisher was offered a chance to plead down to the lesser charge of second-degree manslaughter and a sentence of 2 1/3 to 7 years in state prison, but rejected the deal. If Fisher is found guilty of first-degree manslaughter, he could face 15 to 20 years in prison. Kiefer was offered a chance to plead down to the lesser charge of second-degree gang assault and a sentence of 9 years in state prison, but rejected the deal. He could face life in prison. Brooks family reacts. In a statement from the Brooks family, both Robert Brooks Jr., Brooks's son, and Jared Ricks, Brooks's brother, spoke out against the corrections officers involved and the need for justice. We are grateful that Special Prosecutor William Fitzpatrick obtained these significant plea agreements, said Brooks Jr. It is important to us to see my father's killers publicly admit what they have done and face severe consequences. Ricks talked about the need to see justice is served. These pleas help us know that some measure of justice is served, said Ricks. We are eager to see the others who played a role in my brother's death held to account at the criminal trial. Family faces eviction shortly after loss of their 1-year-old. I'm losing everything at this point, Shantisha Nelson said. Nelson and her husband, Kayon Carter, experienced a tragic loss when their 1-year-old Sanaya died. Now they are facing eviction and have no place to go, as they don't have the money for a hotel or a new place. It's not an uncommon challenge to face in Rochester. Nelson, her husband, and her 2 older children moved into their home in June 2024. Since moving into their place, she noticed that she and her family would often get sick, and worried the kids might be coming into contact with lead and mold. She described how stressed she was over the home in some disrepair and her family constantly getting sick. She eventually decided to stop paying the rent and hasn't made a payment since January. I stopped paying the rent and it built up, Nelson said. Even though Nelson and her family are dealing with an eviction, Nelson feels it is best to move out of their current area because she doesn't feel safe. I feel like I'm being put in a situation for a reason, to get put in a better situation, Nelson said. I'm just hoping and praying that we find a better house. Too many bad things have happened in this house since my baby passed, and I just want it to be over. We reached out to Whiteshirts Realtors Lilac Properties. Kurt Amesbury, broker and owner, said they take good care of their properties and that they are in good shape when people move in. He would not share detail about this particular rental. What can I do if I'm facing an eviction? Here is some advice if you are a renter facing possible eviction. If you receive a notice or court papers for an eviction, act fast by bringing the notice and any other papers received from your landlord to court to try to stop or delay the eviction. In New York, tenants have the right to a 14-day adjournment where they can prepare a defense or seek counsel to represent them in an eviction proceeding. You should also take the notice received and file an order to show cause, which is a request to a housing court judge to stop an eviction. Negotiating with your landlord can also buy a person some time. The tenant and the landlord can reach an agreement when it comes to payment plans or agreeing on a move-out day. What help is there for me? You can seek emergency shelter through Bunyer County's Department of Human Services if you are evicted, or seek the following shelter and relocation services. Open Door Mission at 210 Main Street, Rochester. House of Mercy at 285 Ormond Street, Rochester. Housing Advocacy Services, Munro Housing Collaborative, person-centered housing options, We Link Care by FLIPA. For more information on evictions and legal service providers, contact the Legal Aid Society, the Tenant Defense Project, or Law New York. How to file a housing complaint. If you believe you've experienced unlawful housing discrimination, you can file a complaint with the New York State Division of Human Rights by visiting forms.ny.gov/S3/NYSDHRcomplaint or by calling 888-392-3644. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the Democrat and Chronicle on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Hamas reviewing Gaza peace plan. Group under pressure as Trump issues deadline. President Donald Trump on September 30th gave Hamas 3 to 4 days on to accept a United States-backed peace plan for the Gaza Strip, warning of a very sad end if the group rejected the proposal that he said was close to ending the 2-year-old conflict. Mediators Qatar and Egypt shared the 20-point plan with Hamas late on September 29th, after Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu had appeared alongside Trump at the White House and endorsed the document, saying it satisfied Israel's war aims. Hamas was not involved in the negotiations that led to the proposal, which calls on the Islamist militant group to disarm, a demand it has previously rejected. However, an official briefed on the talks told Reuters that the group would review it in good faith and provide a response. Speaking to reporters in Washington, Trump said Israeli and Arab leaders had already endorsed the plan and that we're just waiting for Hamas to make its decision. He gave the group 3 or 4 days to respond. Hamas is either going to be doing it or not, and if it's not, it's going to be a very sad end, Trump said as he left the White House. Asked whether there was scope for further talks on the proposal, he replied, not much. The plan specifies an immediate ceasefire, an exchange of all hostages held by Hamas for Palestinian prisoners held by Israel, a staged Israeli withdrawal from Gaza, the disarmament of Hamas, and the introduction of a transitional government led by an international body. A source close to Hamas told Reuters the plan was completely biased to Israel and imposed impossible conditions that aimed to eliminate the group. Many elements of the 20 points have been included in numerous ceasefire deals proposed over the past 2 years, including those accepted and then subsequently rejected at various stages by both Israel and Hamas. One of Hamas's main conditions since the outset of the war has been a full Israeli withdrawal from Gaza in return for the release of the remaining hostages. And while the group has indicated its readiness to relinquish administrative authority, it has consistently ruled out disarming. What Trump has proposed is the full adoption of all Israeli conditions, which do not grant the Palestinian people or the residents of the Gaza Strip any legitimate rights, a Palestinian official, who asked not to be named, told Reuters. However, Hamas faces considerable pressure to accept the plan, with the foreign ministers of Saudi Arabia, Jordan, United Arab Emirates, Qatar, and Egypt all welcoming the initiative. Turkey's head of intelligence was set to join Qatari and Egyptian mediators in Doha to discuss the peace proposal on September 30th, a spokesperson for Qatar's foreign ministry said. Turkey has not previously been involved as a key mediator during efforts over the last 2 years to bring peace to Gaza. It was unclear if Hamas officials were to join the September 30th meeting. The last time Hamas leaders gathered to discuss a U.S. peace plan in Qatar, Israel tried, and failed, to kill them with a missile strike. Netanyahu apologized on September 29th to his Qatari counterpart for the September 9th attack, the White House said. Although he initially backed the Trump plan, Netanyahu later expressed doubts about elements of the proposal, including the prospects for eventual Palestinian statehood, something he has repeatedly ruled out. Netanyahu is under mounting pressure from a war-weary Israeli public to end the conflict, but he also risks the collapse of his governing coalition if far-right ministers believe he has made too many concessions for a peace deal. Israeli forces push further into Gaza City. In Gaza itself, some Palestinians hailed Trump's peace plan, saying it could end the bombardment and deaths, but they wondered whether it would end Israel's control of the enclave. "We want the war to end, but we want the occupation army that killed tens of thousands of us to get out and leave us alone," said Salah Abu Amr, 60, a father of six from Gaza City, Gaza Strip. "We hope the plan will end the war, but we are not sure it will. Neither Trump nor Netanyahu can be trusted," he told Reuters via a chat app. Israel began its Gaza offensive after the October 7, 2023 Hamas-led assault on Israel, in which some 1,200 people were killed and 251 taken as hostages. The offensive has killed over 66,000 people in Gaza, Gaza health authorities say. Israeli forces pushed deeper into Gaza City on September 30th. Reaching the center of the territory, which Netanyahu has described as the last Hamas bastion. Israel also ramped up its bombardment of residential districts, forcing more families to leave, witnesses and medics said. At least two people were killed when the Israeli army blew up an explosive-laden vehicle in Beach Camp in western Gaza City, medics said, while nine people, including a mother and five of her children, were killed in two separate attacks in Deir al-Balah and Khan Yunis in the south. Israeli planes also dropped new leaflets over the city, ordering Palestinians to immediately leave and head south. "The battle against Hamas is decisive and will not end until it is defeated," the leaflet said in red writing. Guard asked to deploy to Chicago. Illinois governor says move is about sowing fear and intimidation. Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker told reporters on September 29th that he just learned that the Department of Homeland Security requested the National Guard deploy to the region, despite vociferous objections from the area's leaders. "What I have been warning of is now being realized," Pritzker said at a news conference. "This is not about fighting crime, this is about sowing fear and intimidation among Americans. This is about consolidating power in Donald Trump's hands." The governor said the DHS sent a memo to the Department of War, formerly the Department of Defense, requesting 100 troops from the Illinois National Guard. "The troops," Pritzker said, "are to be used to support immigration and customs enforcement agents carrying out the president's Chicago area immigration enforcement crackdown, known as Operation Midway Blitz." Chief Pentagon spokesperson Sean Parnell confirmed that the Department of War had received a request for troops. Parnell did not say if the National Guard would be deployed. "The Department of War has received a request for assistance to safeguard federal personnel, property, and functions in the state of Illinois," Parnell said. "Any decisions will be made in accordance with established processes and announced at the appropriate time." Trump has been saying since early September that he planned to send the National Guard to Chicago, but the White House had not deployed troops over the objections of the area's leaders. Illinois officials fear that Trump is using clashes between federal agents and anti-immigration enforcement protesters as justification to deploy soldiers. The president said the operation is aimed at catching the worst of the worst criminals who are immigrants. Illinois leaders have said the Republican president's goal is to take control of the heavily Democratic region. Illinois officials did not say when exactly National Guard members would deploy. Pritzker said the memo from Homeland Security to the War Department was the same avenue taken to deploy troops to Portland, Oregon. Illinois Attorney General Kwame Raoul said he was prepared to file a lawsuit against the White House if troops did deploy. In addition to Pritzker and Raoul, the September 29th news conference included Chicago Mayor Brandon Johnson, Cook County President Tony Preckwinkle, and Broadview Mayor Katrina Thompson, whose village outside Chicago has become a hotbed of immigration enforcement and protest. The expected National Guard deployment comes about 3 weeks into the launch of Operation Midway Blitz. DHS officials said more than 700 immigrants have been detained in connection with the operation. Federal immigration enforcement crackdown reflects a significant change of pace for the longtime sanctuary city of Chicago and surrounding areas. Research compiled by the Transactional Records Access Clearinghouse, a research group that tracks immigration enforcement data, shows that over 6,000 people being detained have gone through the region's ICE facility in Broadview. The crackdown has sparked nearly around-the-clock protests at the facility. DHS officials have called protesters rioters, arrested multiple people, and charged at least two protesters with assault. Authorities say they brought handguns to the demonstration. Federal agents have used chemical agents, including pepper spray and tear gas, to disperse Chicago protesters blocking immigration enforcement vehicles. Agents on September 26th also fired chemical agents at protesters and journalists standing in a road leading up to the immigration enforcement facility in Broadview. What we're seeing is our First Amendment rights being eroded by an authoritarian administration determined to diminish dissent, State Senator Karina Vila told reporters on September 29th. The Illinois State Senator's heavily Latino district has seen significant immigration enforcement activity. Broadview officials said the Village Police Department is investigating federal agents for firing crowd control weapons at a news reporter's vehicle. DHS officials did not respond to repeated requests for comment on the investigation. DHS officials have said the Midway Blitz is necessary to catch criminal immigrants, and among the high-profile arrests they tout are people whose criminal history, according to immigration authorities, includes sexual abuse of a child, domestic violence, and battery. You've been listening to a reading of articles and features from the October 1st issue of the Democrat and Chronicle. Your reader has been Aiden Penza. Thank you for listening.